Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to your midweek miracle episode. This episode sort of piggybacks on the last one, the last conversation I had with Mari, which was about creativity and ideas, ancestors, family, legacies, all of that stuff. But mostly, I want to just highlight creativity and ideas and where they come from, because it has to do with my guest this week, Justin Shaw. This quotation is from Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who said, "When I am completely myself, entirely alone, or during the night when I cannot sleep, it is on such occasions that my ideas flow best and most abundantly. Whence and how these ideas come, I know not, nor can I force them." And that quotation is perfect for this episode and perfect for the tale that Justin tells. Now, Justin was always funny, and in fact, he went to LA to become a comedian. And you know what? Justin fell prey of the many pitfalls of being a comedian in LA, the late nights, the alcohol, and he talks about it with complete candor. I mean, he leaves nothing on the table, and it did make his life go sideways for quite a long time. Now, he's coming back and telling us the story of what happened one day when he was on a hike, and that hike changed his life. And this episode should remind all of us that inspiration, the muses, those great energies that weave this universe together, they might just appear when you least expect it. And then what are we supposed to do with these grand ideas? Well, you'll hear what Justin did, because the conversation begins now.
Every piece of information that ever was and ever will be is located in this field. And that is the number of minds in the universe is one. It is this field. It is the mind of God. It is everything. And so that is how things and thoughts get transmitted as well. I've kind of figured out that, you know, that's how, you know, you think of someone and a minute later they call on the phone or something, you know, that's kind of entanglement. Well, my name is Justin L. Shaw. I'm an author. That's kind of the most, that's the easiest one to label myself. But then I like to call myself a lot of fun names. I have a mystical comedian, a hope dealer, spiritual Sherpa. So I kind of make up names for myself because I'm kind of forging a new path and kind of career that's, you know, no one's really done before. So I make up a lot of titles for myself and hopefully they stick. But the one most people can understand the most without saying what is that would be author, I would say.
And I think also comedian, because I read that on your, yeah.
Mystical comedian. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you, when you were a kid, did you think to yourself, gosh, I'm funny?
I did, actually. Yeah, I grew up just around, and there's a lot of this in my, so I'm, the mystical comedian thing is kind of mixing the mysticism and healing and stuff with comedy, because I was originally, you know, my plan originally was to be just a comedian, to kind of move to Hollywood and kind of do that whole thing, and that was a different route, but there was so much comedy growing up. I was in this golden age of comedy. I feel like that was, that early 90s time period when I'm kind of, you know, like in this in between stage and still in, you know, like kind of making that transition in between, you know, like grade school and middle school, that whole magical time period. And that's, you know, kind of when the Simpsons were at the top of their game in the early 90s. And Saturday Night Live was like full of, you know, like Adam Sandler and Chris Rock and David Spade and just like the Yankees lineup. And Jim Carrey had all his movies coming out. And it was just like that early mid 90s was just so magical, I think. And so there's a lot of pop culture. You know, it's the medium I speak through. You know, Jesus was such an effective spiritual leader and teacher because he was able to find things of the time period and try to kind of explain this source energy, the mysticism, through the things of the time period that people would understand. Well, we're in a different time period now. And so what's the language of the times, pop culture? So that's what I use to explain the mysticism in this spiritual energy I've found.
Amazing. I'm really curious, where did you grow up?
Scottsdale, Arizona.
Okay.
And I'm still here. Yeah. In the kind of Phoenix area. Yep.
Okay. So did you just look around as a kid and think, gosh, there's so many funny things happening around me, and you just use that as fodder for kind of just being out in the world? And, you know, because I think sometimes kids understand when they're young that they're funny, and people love funny people. And when you're a kid, if you're funny, other kids are like, I want to hang out with you. Were you kind of like the popular funny kid at school?
It is definitely how I made friends. So I was there. There was a time period where I was living in Boston for a couple years in very early grade school, second grade. And I was being bullied at the time. And what happened was I turned it around and started making him laugh. And all of a sudden this bully became my friend. So, you know, like, and so it's, you know, if you attack the situation with love, you know, peace will follow. So I have found that is how I've been able to make friends. And the best was to make my mom laugh. She had her own kind of issues, and, you know, it was kind of a tough, you know, childhood. It was just her and I most of the time. And she had, you know, her own kind of major anxiety and depressive issues, and to make her laugh sometimes was just all that was, it's all I wanted to do. So, you know, I would do these voices, and, you know, I would imitate things in the radio, and, you know, like, and do, you know, imitations of like the president at the time, George Bush. I wasn't really doing George Bush. I was doing Dana Carvey doing George Bush, but she just thought it was hilarious. So, you know, so I was just like, so, you know, so she thought it was really funny. And that's what, you know, made me feel good, was making her laugh. And when I decided to invite friends in my life, I was very much of a loner, especially in the middle school time period. I really was trying to find myself. I just kind of liked being alone most of the time. But, you know, in high school, I really sought after friends, and partying and making people laugh was how I found them.
Amazing. People love other people who make them laugh. I mean, I think it helps them kind of rise up out of their regular lives. So laughing, you know, if you're having a hard time in your life, being around someone that makes you laugh can remind you that the world is a good place. So let me ask you, when you were a kid, I asked this question, but I suspect that ever since you were a kid, you always knew you wanted to be a comedian. Would you say that's true? Like, that was it. Not an astronaut, not a fireman, not, it was like comedian.
Actually, it was basketball player. that was the main thing, was like NBA. But, you know, like, I found it really quickly. I am not nearly, you know, I couldn't even cut it, you know, making the high school team. So that was a dream that faded really quickly. And so that the fallback was comedian. Yeah, it was. I would like to do that. And that was a realistic thing for me. And I kind of got through high school and college with that in mind. And I went and I moved out to LA. But, you know, that's when I was onslaughted with just, you know, drugs and, you know, the trauma from everything really kicked in. And it just was awful. I mean, you know, like, to be a stand up comedian, you need to be able to finish a set standing up, right? Like, so, you know, like, I was doing so many, you know, like, drugs and alcohol at the time, like, it was just barely functional. So, you know, that standing up for an entire set was almost, you know, something that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, it just, things shifted. So that's kind of what happened with the comedian career.
Yeah. I'm so curious. How did you get the, I don't know, bravery, audacity to leave Arizona and go to LA? How did that happen?
I was high. I was probably high when I made that decision. So, but that's okay. That's all right. It just was like, I just was trying to find myself and do things different. And, you know, I kind of say in jest that I was high, but I was, you know, I was high a lot back then. So, you know, it just was something I wanted to do. And I was trying to, you know, kind of find an answer to my pain. And I felt like that was an answer. But, you know, it just did there. There's only one answer, and that wasn't the answer. So that's why that didn't work out so well for me. But, you know, like, and it's fine. You know, like, now I realized that I can use all those talents that I have, you know, that I was hoping to use in my life for something completely different. And instead of just making people laugh, I can make them think and feel at the same time. So if you kind of like, you know, if you cycle through that, laugh, think, feel, you know, like now you've really got something and you can really grab people's attention and make a difference in their life, because, you know, healing trauma doesn't have to be, you know, serious all the time. I mean, there are times when there needs to be serious, but it really does not need to be taken that seriously all the time. And the healing energy of laughter is extremely healing. So like in the book, I go in and I have some really funny stories about being in rehab. I was in rehab with DMX for a couple of days. And so there's a really funny story that I go into in the very beginning. And then I kind of make my life funny. Like there's all these tragic things that happen, but I'm able to make them in a very funny, jokey way. Cause you only accept, believe, and surrender to the energy you're currently in. If you're listening to something and you're in the energy of fear, you're not really in the energy of healing. You know, you're in the energy to hear more things of that energy, which is why the news is so, you know, just can be so destructive, because it gets people in that energy of fear. And now they're willing to accept and believe all these fear driven things because they're already in that energy. If you're in the energy of joy, it's just like, yeah, whatever. I want to go to something more joyful. So it was really important to get people to heal, that they be in the right energy before entering into the healing section of the book. So the first part of it is really funny.
Well, I want to tell you that I read the 3 pages you sent me and I just thought it just resonated. I love your approach. It's so welcoming and it's easygoing. It's funny. Oh my God, it's funny. And it's not overwhelming. You know, sometimes you can pick up a book and someone says, I have something to tell you. And the first, I don't know, 5 pages are so heavy and intense. You're like, I don't know if I can get through this. This feels like I got to put my waders on and slog through this. Mm-hmm. But yours is really enchanting. It's really fun and light, effervescent, but you have this great way of saying powerful truths in a really funny way so that people can, you know, everyone can approach it and feel like welcomed in. I am curious, when you were a kid, did you ever think, I mean, could you ever have imagined that you've been doing the work that you're doing now?
No, never. I would have never. Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, I wouldn't have a clue. Like, I didn't even know this was an option. I still wasn't aware this, you know, this kind of thing is an option, because I still don't know what exactly this looks like for me. You know, like the book just came out a few months ago, and you know, I'd love to kind of do, you know, like book tours and lectures where I'm kind of like the mystical comedian and making people laugh, think, and feel. And you know, I there isn't any alcohol involved in my shows, and I don't have to go on stage at 10 o'clock at night. And you know, there's all these things that the life of a comedian is not easy and it's not fun. You know, like I found out that really quickly. It's like you don't go to work until 10 p.m. at night and everyone's drinking. And it's just like, this is not a safe or a healthy atmosphere for me personally, because I am sober. I like being sober. I can be in that atmosphere, but, you know, but, and it's fine, but it's just not an atmosphere I want to constantly be in. So, you know, yeah, I had no idea that my life would leave here, but it's so far it's pretty fun and I'm enjoying the ride. You know, I like to say, you know, the journey is the destination. So it's just kind of keeping an open mind and open heart to anything that comes along.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have social anxiety. So in the past, if I have to go to a party where I kind of don't know anyone or maybe just know one person, I'm like, I'm going to have a couple drinks beforehand or I will not be able to breathe once I get to the party. Like I just won't, because I just can't handle it. I actually can't even imagine getting on stage and being a comedian. For me, that is just maybe the most terrifying thing that I could ever do. So anyone who does it, who puts themselves out there like that, I have to bow down to them, because that is such an insanely vulnerable place. You're like, are they going to like my stuff? Are they not going to like my stuff? Are they going to laugh? You know, what is it? What's going to happen? And so, and also I like to go to bed early these days. So starting at 10 is just nightmarish as well. But this was happening when you were younger and you're like, I can stay up all night. But I do have to commend you for just being brave and putting yourself up there. It is being a comedian is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. Well, I'd say courageous. So bravery is going through without feeling the fear. Courageous is feeling the fear and doing it anyway. So it certainly was not brave because at the time I was feeling a lot of fear and I just did it anyway. But, you know, in recent times, I've really found, you know, such a healthy way to deal with fear. You know, fear and joy are not two separate coins. They're two sides of the same coin. So it is all the same energy, fear and joy. And when you're experiencing fear, it's that energy being filtered through BS, belief systems, right? So it's being filtered through old belief systems that are not in line with who you currently are. So that energy is getting filtered through that old BS, and it's getting filtered through, and it's not in line with who you are. So it's time to, and that's certainly what I did in my life was, okay, what am I fearing? What is all this? And you know, you talk about the religion and stuff. That was a big part of my life back in the day. And there was a lot of things. There was a lot of things that caused a lot of fear because of that. And having, you know, recognizing what that fear is and questioning those old belief systems that are not in line with who I am helped me immensely overcome fear. And joy is what's experienced when you're experiencing that same energy filtering through belief systems that are in line with who you are. So it's, yeah, they're two sides of the same coin. And you just, if you have a healthy relationship and become like kind of friends with your fear, and that's how you do it. Yeah.
Thank you. I want to ask you something about what I read in that first three pages. But first, since you brought it up already, I'll ask you the second question first, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like? And how has that kind of relationship with something outside yourself, the divine energy, whatever you choose to call it, how has that evolved over time?
Yeah, that's like my favorite thing to talk about. So yeah, growing up, it wasn't really very religious. My mom had me go to Sunday school, but it was kind of like she didn't go. And, you know, my dad wasn't really big into it. And he was only around when I was younger. And, you know, it was barren healthy relationship. So that split when I was younger. So, but, you know, I kind of went to Sunday school and it just wasn't for me. So when I had a say in the matter, and my mom was like, she didn't care because she didn't go anyways. So she's like, yeah, it's fine, whatever. You know, so 12 years old, just stopped going. It wasn't until later on that I started with the BS that got put in there. And that was the first time through rehab. I just was like, okay, so just get me clean and I'll be fine. My problems are not of this spiritual nature. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I am suffering because I am having withdrawals from all this Oxycontin and alcohol and Xanax I'm doing and Adderall and just everything. So just like, just get me clean and then I'm going to feel better and I'm not going to want to do it again. Period. End of story. Well, that lasted for 3 months and I'm shocked it even lasted that long. So the second time in rehab, it was like, okay, all right, fine. I was wrong. I'm willing to admit it. There must be some kind of spiritual aspect to this whole thing that I'm missing because I'm here I am again. And so I went to this kind of more faith-based treatment center on purpose. And it was, you know, very kind of Christian leaning. And of course, you know, AA is essentially disguised Christianity. They kind of go together like, you know, peanut butter and jelly. So I did the AA Christian thing for quite a while. And, you know, that kept me sober. But, it wasn't bringing to my life what I was hoping it would. I was functional in society, which was a win, but I still had all this stuff in me that was holding me back from who I truly was. And I have found that Christianity for me was, you know, at the time I was like living in this big, huge mansion. It has, you know, like 17 bedrooms and plenty of bathrooms. And there's a basketball court and there's a pool and there's a game room and a theater room. And there's all these amazing things inside the house. But you're told you can't go outside the house. That's the deal with living inside the house. You can't go outside because there is a zombie apocalypse out there and you're going to die. So, you know, you don't go investigating other religions. You don't go investigating, you know, even yoga, meditation. These are taboo things that you shouldn't just, that's the devil, you know, like, it's like, it's just this insanity. So I didn't. And, but I realized, you know, my mother was pronounced terminally ill, and it was a very hard year that I went through watching her mind and body kind of dwindle away, the dementia taking over, the cancer eating her body. And what made things 1,000 times worse was, you know, this programming in my head was said that my mother is going to hell. Like, not only is she going to suffer for this year, my mother's going to hell because she never went to church. She did nothing. So she is damned forever. And so I realized that this beautiful home I was living in was built on a cracked foundation of control, fear, and judgment and shame. And so the building started completely crumbling around me. Of course, I went right back to drugs and alcohol because, you know, I was trying to, you know, my pastor's words weren't doing a thing. They were making things worse. And so, you know, I did that for a while. And so, but then I started leaving the mansion. And even though I was still, you know, she had passed on, and I was just trying to figure out where she was and what all this stuff was. And so I replaced my pastor with a shaman, and that's when things really started to change. And that's when the growth started happening, and, you know, the yoga and meditation started coming in, and I started deconstructing this old BS, these old belief systems of, you know, and I started realizing, you know, Christianity is controlling people with shame. They're keeping people in the church and from straying to church and using shame as a control. And that's what they were doing with me. They were using my shame as a control. And I wasn't in this, oh, you know, crazy cult or anything. This is just a Bible church. But I realized that that's what was happening, was they were controlling me by shame. And that's what a lot of the churches do, even if they're not, you know, deep cults. They, you know, they're not controlling you in any sort of way that's, you know, like cults do with, you know, like, you know, people around you, and, you know, you build this entire life that's based, you know, like, a lot of times you're living with the people in the cult, and to get kicked out of that, and there's none of that, but they still can use your shame and control. And that's what was happening. So once I started realizing that and started deconstructing these beliefs and realizing that, you know, I'm a little piece of this bigger picture, like, you know, I'm a little slice of God, and we are all little slices of God. You know, a slice of pizza is still pizza, isn't it? Like, so, you know, we're all we're like, you know, little glasses of water that have been taken out of the ocean and just sat, and, you know, that there we spend our lives as a glass of water. And then at the end we get poured back in, and that's all it is. And so it's just so different. And that's when I kind of had my first bliss attack, which is a lot of fun to talk about. It was, and this is what has put me on the path I'm on now. This was about 4 years ago. And, you know, I was doing all these things at the time, but I wasn't actually meditating at the time, but I was taking up meditation. I was doing these work with a shaman. I was doing the belief systems. And so just one day, there was no drugs involved in this whatsoever. I was drug free for probably about a month at that time. I was kind of swinging back and forth. I'd go in benders and then go sober. And so that's kind of what I was jerking my body around. But I was sober for about a month at this time. And it was like a panic attack if you replace panic with love. So it really was something otherworldly. And in this was a 3-hour bliss attack. And during that time, I was being kind of told things, downloaded messages, and it made me realize that I was in airplane mode my whole life. You know, a phone in airplane mode is not living up to its potential, right? So, you know, like, I realized that everyone around me was in airplane mode too. No one really knew what was going on with, like, and what this world really was and all the amazingness. It's like, there's this field and this substance that surrounds us at all times. And it's like we're fish swimming in the ocean, but fish aren't aware of the water they're swimming in. Like, if you explain water to a fish, it's not going to have any idea what you're talking about. So it's like I woke up to that and realized that, you know, and then once you see the water, you can't unsee the water. And then you want to tell all the other fish about the water. And then you go around trying to tell fish about water, and it's hard to do. It's like, well, it's the substance around it. It surrounds us. We leave because we breathe. It's everywhere. And it's like, you know, another fish isn't going to have any idea what you're talking about. So you know, that's the kind of growth that it kind of sprung in that moment. And I've been kind of chasing. I've had several bliss attacks, and that's the thing with a bliss attack. You can't expect it to come. You can't make it come. It just comes on its own. And I can't go into meditation, you know, with that in mind. You know, you can't have any expectations when you go into a meditation, but that's what I created this system as, like a map for other people to have their own bliss attack. And so, yeah, it was just, it's been quite a ride, and where it leads, you know, like this is the very beginning. It's very fun to think about where this all could go, but yeah, that's kind of been my, you know, in a nutshell a little bit, that's my spiritual journey from religion to spirituality. They're very different concepts. You know, religion, you're a fish in a bowl, you know, spirituality, you're a fish in the ocean. So, you know, it's a big difference. And so that's kind of been my awakening so far.
Wow. I'm listening to you and I'm just utterly flabbergasted, and just, I would so appreciate you telling me, you know, you use the words bliss attack, which I kind of think I understand what you're saying, but how is that different from joy? Like, is joy just a daily choice? Bliss attacks steal up on you unawares. I would imagine the feeling is a little bit different between each. I'd love to hear whatever you think.
Yeah, the bliss attack is a whole nother level of it really is. Bliss is the best word to explain for it. Bliss, love. There's a big difference. So joy, which there's a big difference, and I explain this in the book, is a big difference between joy and happiness. So happiness is kind of the thing you get when you're doing whatever it is that makes you happy, whether it's, you know, it could be something healthy like sports and exercise, spending time with the kids, that, you know, that can be happiness. It can be more negative things like gambling, drugs, alcohol. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with those things. It's the attachment to them that causes our suffering. So, you know, the chains of addiction are too weak to notice until they're too strong to break. And so if you're constantly, you know, going from one that's a happiness chaser, you're going from one thing to another, and just like, you know, if your thing is, you know, fishing on the weekends, and you just drag through the week miserable, and you're just trying to get through to the weekend where you have your happiness, and then you're just, it's back to misery again. That's the happiness chaser. And that's, you're just going from one thing to make you happy to the other with no joy in between. Joy is what you experience when you're not doing any of those happiness chasing things. It's this inner peace. And it's just this feeling that everything is, you know, is okay. And it's just this positive feeling that, you know, you don't need these things to have joy. You can have joy whenever, you know, money can't buy happiness. It sure can. It can buy all the happiness you want. Money cannot, however, buy joy. And that's what I'm after is joy. So, you know, that's the big difference. And the bliss attack is just a completely different level. It's way above joy and happiness. Like I never felt a drug, all the drugs and alcohol I did, nothing matched this level. So if you think of, this is well past anything that makes you happy. It's way past that. Joy, it's way past that. It's a whole nother level, like of feeling. And yeah, it's very hard to explain, certainly. But, you know, it's that water to a fish, you know, explanation. It's like, I don't know how to put this in words, but that's kind of the best way I can describe, you know, that joy, happiness, and this bliss attack is just this other level past all that.
Thank you. I wanted to read this quotation from Erwin Schrödinger, and I've never heard it before, and I wanted to get your idea or thoughts, which you of course talk about in the book, but just for the podcast, for my audience. So you have in the book, it says, famed physicist Erwin Schrödinger said the total number of minds in the universe is one. And I just thought that was so beautiful and so just powerful and revelatory. Oh my gosh. What does that mean to you?
That is the field. So that is what I connected to write the book. That is this this substance that surrounds us. There's nothing here, but there is something here. It is the substance that surrounds us. It is, you can call it the mind of God, and it can be tapped into at any time. It can be tapped into like a Wi-Fi signal. Like, you know, if you have, just like with airplane mode, like you turn airplane mode off, all of a sudden you're getting the signals in and you're getting emails and texts and you've got access to the internet, right? You know, like a computer with its Wi-Fi off isn't as useful. You don't get in as, so it's turning on the Wi-Fi signal, and the brain doesn't store information like they used to think. It's the receiver in which we access this field, and every piece of information that ever was and ever will be is located in this field. And that is the number of minds in the universe is one. It is this field. It is the mind of God. It is everything. And so that is how things and thoughts get transmitted as well. I've kind of figured out that, you know, that's how, you know, you think of someone and a minute later they call on the phone or something, you know, that's kind of entanglement. Two particles separated, you know, can have effect on one another. And how that happens is if you consider water, the field is the conductor, but it's also the stimulant and it's made up of the same thing. So it's like, so if you're in a pool and, you know, you don't have to be right next to a strike of lightning to get electrocuted. If you're in a pool, you know, like if the lightning strikes, you know, like 20 yards away and you're in a big pool and it's, you're still going to get electrocuted because the water is the conductor for the electricity. But if you're in the ocean and, you know, you're swimming off the coast of Florida and lightning strikes off Cuba, you're not going to feel anything because electricity is limited by the, you know, the laws of classical physics, which is it can only travel so far, so fast. But the field, consider the field that water and your thought, the bolt of electricity, like an information. But the bolt of electricity is like being transferred in an ocean of electricity. So it's instantaneous and it doesn't slow down as fast. So the stimulant and the conductor are the same thing. So that's how, you know, psi works, ESP, all these, you know, interesting things that they used to research more back in the 70s. There's a lot of research that came out with that and they probably still are. Maybe they're doing it more undercover because that's kind of more out in the open. But yeah, that is the mind of God. That is the field, and it is conductor, and it is a sea of consciousness, and that's how things get transmitted. It's just, you know, it's not limited by the laws of physics because the stimulant and the conductor are the same substance.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. Thank you. All of that, and I just think it's so weird that I don't know if there's so much stigma and shame around that kind of research into psi and ESP. And I think to myself, because I've certainly had a number of experiences that quote unquote could not be explained by the Western scientific model. And I don't know why there's so much fear and terror. And I don't know, just whenever nobody's doing the research. I mean, some people are, but it's very much, it feels like it has to be under the radar and hush hush. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, can you even imagine how much more amazing the world's going to get if we, you know, utilize this capacity? I want to read something again from your book, which I love the title. Okay. Sorcery 101. I just thought to myself, and it's spelled S-O-U-R instead of S-O-R. But one of the things that I thought was really, really beautiful and powerful is, the end before you give the creed. And it's interesting just because based on where we are as a culture, society, nation, actually world, as far as social media and influencers and all sorts of things. I love this. A sorcerer is someone that has developed the ability to alchemize their emotions and has learned how to respond instead of react to frustrating worldly situations. A sorcerer does not view the world from an involved black and white standpoint, like most of humanity, but from a loving and detached shade of gray. But most of all, a sorcerer knows they are special, but not unique. And I thought to myself, I think everybody needs to read this because we live in a world where a lot of people think that they're unique and everybody in the world needs to know this about them. And that not only are they you know, the most unique person ever, but they're totally special and we need to worship them or pay them or do all these things. But I, you know, considering the political situation in the US, I really, really appreciated the, you know, let's respond in a thoughtful way, in a way that's considerate and kind and thoughtful versus react like so much that we see these days. Just beautiful. What a beautiful introduction.
Thank you.
Yeah. Was it nerve-wracking to put this book out into the world?
Yes. Yeah. No, it definitely was. And it's, you know, it's still is. And there are going to be people that just, you know, especially people on the two opposite sides of the spectrum, which is, you know, the atheists and the zealots, you know, they're going to hate these ideas because they don't fall in line with either camp. And I am not someone that picks sides, because picking sides means you've picked a side. And so, you know, there are better ways to go about things. I think American politics is just a giant illusion. I think it's kind of a joke, and it is full of just people just constantly reacting, and you have to fall into this camp or that camp. And if you fall into this camp, you have to like everything of this. And if you fall into that camp, you have to accept everything that this camp, it's just like, what? Why? No, it's giving the choice of like, it's an old sales trick. I used to be in sales, and so we'd, you know, we used to sell phones, and that was how we used to sell people. And we wouldn't give them a choice. It's like, you know, we'd kind of narrow down out of our several phones which ones they would want to do. And then we'd say, do you want A or B? And that's it. And then you say nothing. And that's the old sales trick. It's like, okay, they don't have a choice. They're going to either choose A or B. And they're not going to linger and say, well, what about, you know, like, what about other options? It's just like, no, you give them a choice. It's A or B. That's it. That's your choice. And that's what we've done with kind of American politics and kind of with religion. You're either in camp religion or you're in camp science. And there's none of this gray. And, you know, I said the sorcerer sees everything in the world of gray. And that's where the truth lies. It's a little bit of this. It's a little bit of this. You know, you're right. You're both right and wrong at the same time. Democrats have great ideas, but they also have crappy ideas. Republicans have great ideas, and they also have crappy ideas. And the truth is in the gray. And the same goes for religion and science. It's that spirituality falls right in the middle of the two. And people like things in that black and white camp. It's like, it is or it isn't, and that's it. And our minds, there are good people and there are bad people, and that's it. And it's just the wrong way to think. And it is possible to change your thinking. And that's what this is about, is trying to get people to see things from a different point of view.
Amazing. I am all for that. I'm a fan of different points of view, but also I'm a fan of just how expansive, you know, the book is, your thought process. It's really generous. And I think you're asking the reader to embrace the same generosity of spirit being in the world and the same expansiveness and kindness of being in the world, but also the idea that, hey, you know, we can co-create, we can be in this and commit to it and bring a lot of beauty for a whole lot of other people. So it's really, it's unbelievable. And of course, I loved your, the Hogwarts reference, the Harry Potter reference at the beginning. I was like, this guy's funny. This guy is funny. I'm just telling everybody out there that, no, he really is funny. Well, I'd love for you to share a story, or more than one story, about, you've shared about your bliss attacks, but I'd love for you to share with my audience a story where in your life at some point you feel like you witnessed something magical, miraculous, or even mysterious, something that changed your worldview again, like the bliss attacks.
Yeah, I mean, I've had many of these. I had a lot of growing to do in the 4 years before, you know, like that. It's really in the past 2 years that things have taken into overdrive. I had an instance that, you know, I've had, you know, I had a tough kind of childhood. It was more neglect than anything. Just emotional neglect. My mother didn't understand the concept of love, so she didn't understand healthy how that worked. But in my adulthood, I experienced a lot of, like, you know, just a lot of loss. And aside from my mother, is my sister, and you know, I had a childhood friend, and then I was in a relationship at the time that had to end, but we had an infant child, and she took that child and moved across the country, said she was going to stay in contact, and then just blacked out. So I haven't talked to seen my son in 2.5-3 years now. So it's, you know, that kind of loss, you know, will bring people to, you know, their knees. And, you know, so I moved to Sedona as kind of a trauma response. And, you know, right after that happened and dealing with a whole lot. And, you know, I kind of went to Bell Rock, and it's kind of one of these very famous, you know, vortex places, and put out there that it was like, I'm here. And, you know, the natives used to go to Sedona. They didn't really live up there as much as they'd go up there to heal. And then they'd kind of come back to where they were. So when I moved there, I was thinking, I was just like, I'm just going to move here and be here. But that's not how it turned out. And it turned out that I kind of did what the natives did. And I lived there for a year. But in that time period, I just had, you know, crazy things happen. And so when I was there the first day, I did this really intense meditation for like an hour on Bell Rock, and just like, show me what I'm supposed to do, because things are not going so well in my life right now. And I could really use some direction, right? Like, so, you know, I did that. And then a few months later, I was just, you know, walking in the wilderness, and, you know, I was kind of having this dialogue with my intuition and my higher self up there, which is kind of the player character, the player out there. It's like the simulation theory in the video game. It's like the one who's controlling you with the controls on the other side of the TV. That's your higher self. And so once you're in contact, and there's a lot in there to get in contact with that, with your higher self, once you're in contact with the person on the other side of the video game, you're in true control of your life. And so I was just talking, and I was kind of just like, well, you know, I'd be good at this. Like, I feel like I've come a long way in my healing, and, you know, I'm just having this conversation. I've come a long way. And, I just said, you know, out loud, like, it's like, you know, I'd be good at this. And in that moment, that's when the book came, and the idea for the you and the sorcery and the 13 rungs. Cause so there, I was in AA for a long time, and that's kind of what sparked, like, you know, a guiding system. People need, it can't just be a book. There has to be like a system that people can follow and to have their own kind of awakening. So, you know, 12 steps, it's like, well, you know, they're very rigid, you know, of course it's based in religion. Religion's very strict and rigid. So the 12 steps are very strict and rigid, and you know, you're powerless, and you go, you know, this and you go that step. And, you know, so, okay, let's make something way more fluid that, you know, like you can focus on one, go to the other, and, you know, move back and forth. So this is much more fluid. And, you know, moving forward steps, well, that's good. But moving up, well, that's better, because, you know, a bird has a better perspective on things than a worm. So rungs. So you're moving up and you're getting a better perspective on your life. So that's when everything kind of came to me all at once, in that moment after I asked. And I just simply had to ask and be ready. And it all came to me, and I was just like, I was having another bliss attack in that moment. And like, so I was having, this was probably my third or fourth one, and just having this all at once, and everything just kind of coming to me, and was like, this is what you're going to do. This is how you're going to do it. And that just all came to me. And that was the greatest hike of my life, let me tell you. So, you know, that's one of those things that I can definitely look back on, and just, you know, it gives me chills just thinking about it. But yeah, that would be one of those times.
Yeah, it's kind of maybe one of the last things you expect to happen while you're on a hike.
Yeah. You can't expect that. That's the key. Can't expect anything. Can't expect anything. That's when it comes, when you're not expecting it. Yep. Yeah, I mean, there's always doubt. You always have. There's always some sort of doubt that comes in, but then I just realized that this was given to me, and like, I just need to do it. And whatever this energy is that gave this to me is going to help me along the way. And I was still struggling with kind of drinking back and forth, and it was like, well, that's got to go. It's going to interrupt the signal. You know, that's the first thing. It's got to go. So, you know, That was before I kind of moved back to Phoenix at, I started it, but I realized I needed more help. So I got completely clean. And that's when the signal really started becoming really clear. And I just kept doing it. And just every day, even if it was for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I took out my 401k that I had saved from the mortgage company. And I thank them for that, because that allowed me to not work for a year, 18 months, a year. And just, you know, it wasn't a big amount, but it was enough that I didn't have to work for you, and I could focus completely on this. And so that's what I did every day. I focused on healing myself while at the same time writing this book. So it's a very meta experience. As I'm writing this book, I'm healing myself and writing about it. Writing what I'm going through and having to write the book and then reading it. And I probably have gone through it 100 times and changing everything and putting little jokes in here and there. But that made me read it, I've read it over 100 times. I've read this book. And so now it's programmed into my psyche. And it is the greatest thing to program into your psyche, because now I can call on it when I need it and things are there. It's like, okay, what am I feeling? What am I working on? And it just turned me into a different person. I mean, it's the craziest story. It's a crazy story. And it's so much fun. And that's what I want to. But everyone has one of these stories in them. And that's what, I am not unique. I'm special, but not unique, right? Like that's everyone, whatever is in me is in everyone, everyone. So it's just a matter of follow your bliss. Like Joseph Campbell said, that's one of the rungs, is follow your bliss, finding what puts you in that flow state and just follow it and see where it goes. A lot of people don't even know, what that is, that thing that where time disappears, that's your flow state. And that's really, and it's not the indulgence. If it's like, well, that's drinking for me, it's like, well, you're not allowing, something better to come in, cause you're drinking too much. It's, that's that drugs and alcohol do not count for the flow state. But it's pursuing that and something will come out of it. I don't know what it is. It's your journey. I have no idea, but I can tell you that once you find that and you follow it, doors will open where there are only walls. That's all I can tell you.
I love that quotation. It's so true and so real. And you kind of beat me to the punch, because I was going to just comment and say that healing looks different for different people, because we're all individuals. What one person needs to heal might be completely different for someone else. So yeah, so it's not going to be one size fits all. On someone's healing journey, if someone says, okay, what I'm doing is not working, or my attitude towards the universe is not entirely healthy or truly connected, after they, think about and contemplate, what is my bliss? What would be your one piece of advice for beginning that healing journey?
The number one thing, first and foremost, before you follow and find your bliss, is to heal the trauma. Because trauma clouds our judgment. It sits in our frontal lobe right here. And it just clouds everything. There's no way to think clearly or properly if you have unhealed trauma in your frontal lobe. So that is our personality. It's our impulse control. It's everything that makes us human is in our frontal lobe. And that's where the trauma sits and clouds. So the number one thing is to first, isn't necessarily to go find your bliss. It's to heal that trauma. And so I like to compare, doctors in today's society, or I don't like to bemoan them, but the truth is it is the mind, body, spirit triangle. All three are equally as important, and leaving one out is going to heavily affect the other two, and feeding one will in turn feed the other two. And it is that triangle that has to be respected. And the medical community is just now, within the last 10 or 20 years, saying, oh, maybe the mind and body are connected. Oh, I guess we're wrong. Maybe they are connected, but the spirit is still left out and doesn't exist and will continue to be left out. You're not going to go to a doctor, and you're not going to go into a psychiatrist and, tell him about, your issues that you're having. And he's not going to say, well, it sounds like maybe your root chakra is out of line. Maybe you should go see a shaman. That's not going to happen. So you have to figure that stuff out on your own. And that's what people like me are here to do. They're alternate forms. And so, the medical community is amazing at acute injuries. If I fall off a ladder and there is a bone sticking out of my arm, it's not a good time for acupuncture. Meditation, going into the corner and just meditating, it isn't going to get the kind of healing I'm after. And if you leave a wound like that unhealed, like our trauma, when you touch it, it's going to hurt and it's going to sting and you're going to always be holding your arm away from everything and protecting it. Because if someone touches it, you're going to react. You're not going to respond. You're going to react. And that's the same with trauma. But once, so the doctor goes in, sets the bone, and, but it is the body that heals. What made the body heals the body. The doctor's part is done. The doctor does not heal the body. The doctor just sets the bone. And so what the kind of, what I'm after and kind of the shaman way of doing things is setting the emotional and spiritual bone for trauma. Otherwise it won't heal. Like you can't just, time does not heal all wounds. That is the bullshit that it, you know, like it is, that is the biggest, one of the biggest fallacies we're told. Time does not heal all wounds. Time will make it so that it's not so bad, but then it just recedes into the subconscious and then it's an unhealed wound. And so that is, you have to set the emotional/spiritual bone in order for that trauma to heal and to cloud up. And all of a sudden now you can be connected to that source. And so, and that's what I've kind of made is this map to help heal trauma. And I promise that's what it does. And so if you follow it effectively and down to it, it will, and there's other things that can be done. You know, I'm a heavy believer in the kind of rebooting of your brain through, you know, treatments like the ketamine treatments and, you know, the ayahuasca or the mushrooms. And I'm a firm believer that that can start. So if you're in a place, you know, that's a really good starting place because you don't have to do them over and over. The medical community wants to just, you know, just look at the symptoms and just treat your symptoms so that you become dependent on those drugs. Hallucinogens are not like that. You have a few treatments and it has a rewiring, rebooting effect in the brain. But then that's where my system comes in is you have to keep with it. You have to keep with this new brain and this rewiring. So the two of them, I feel like, is a really amazing place to start with kind of like having an experience and, you know, setting it. But then you have to make changes in your life and make it, because if you have an experience and you have the ketamine or ayahuasca and then you go back to being you, you're going to still be you. It's just, you're going to have these be like, oh, remember that? Remember who I wanted to be? Well, now I'm back being me. So things have to change. So the combination of these two, I think, is going to be extremely effective into rewiring the brain and the neuroplasticity and making that transformation happen. So I think it's very important to know that. And you can do it without the hallucinogens, and, you know, because this is just a new way of, this is a path to change your brain naturally. I just think it's can be a good place to start, because I did that. I did the ketamine treatments and that kind of rebooted and then started writing the book and getting into a new me and haven't had to do it since. So it's not this constant like pill, go see a doctor every month, take a pill every day. And there's always side effects to those pills. I mean, if you're on them, I'm not saying get off them, but there's always, whether it's doing something you want it to do or not want it to do, you know, there are these side effects of, you know, like, I was, you know, I'd be on Zoloft and it'd be like, I'm super tired now. Like this isn't helping at all. Like this isn't, so there's other ways to doing things. And that's what this is. There are, the shamanistic route is for any disease labeled chronic. So that can be a physical disease labeled chronic. I mean, cancer is a big one. There are, you know, I believe that there is a cure for cancer and it's belief, you know? So, and that's the really tough thing is when a doctor comes in and says, okay, I'm really sorry to say, you know, you have cancer. Okay, well now you're in this place of fear and, you know, sadness. You're in this energy, this horrible energy. And then you ask the doctor, well, doc, how long do I have? And then they say, well, 6 months. Well, now that doctor, the jerk, has now programmed you to die because you are in the state to accept what he's saying, because you're in a state of fear and he says 6 months and then you accept 6 months and you're dead in 6 months. You know, the correct answer is, well, that's up to you, because that is the correct answer, because you can turn things around. People have come up from incurable diseases, given weeks to live, and they say, no, I disagree. And that's how they are still alive 30 years later. You know, they put their foot down and say, no, I don't agree with that. You can agree with the prognosis, the diagnosis. You can agree with the diagnosis. It is what it is. It's cancer. Fine. the prognosis is bullshit. No doctor should be giving prognosis because the belief is everything in these chronic diseases, whether the placebo effect is a very great example of that. The belief is everything. So there is a cure for cancer, and it's belief.
Think that there is a new way of being coming into this world. I'm hoping at least more community, more collaboration, more understanding that source, inspiration, the great gods that rule this universe are far closer than we actually understand. And I do believe that they want to be in collaboration with us. They want each and every one of us to attain our goals, live our gifts, and bring more beauty into the world. And it's clear that Justin has done exactly that. I mean, he could have taken his inspiration, his idea, and run away and said, no, I'm not doing this. But instead, Justin stepped forward and he embraced the idea. And, you know, there we go, the 401k. He had enough time to sit back and bring it to life. If you want to read up a little bit more about Justin and what he's doing in the world, there will be a few links in the episode show notes so you can see what it is that Justin's into. I want to thank each and every one of you for listening. I need to thank Justin for being on the podcast. All of you sending me your notes, your texts, telling me how much you love the podcast, they keep me going. So thank you so much. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Justin. Be open to the idea that you can be going about your life, whether you're shopping at the grocery store, helping a neighbor walk her dog, going to work, and that inspiration can strike at any time. You just have to be open to it. Anais Nin said, "My ideas usually come not at my desk writing, but in the midst of living." And so I think it behooves each of us to try to get into the flow, to get into the idea of co-creating with the universe, to get into the idea of capturing those ideas that are floating out in the ether. And, you know, I keep urging us to bring beauty into the world. I keep urging us to live into our gifts. And I think, you know, if you open yourself up to co-collaboration, if you open yourself up to co-creation, and you just think, all right, idea, I'm ready. Come sit on my heart. Come lay on my shoulders. I just can't even imagine what's going to happen. It's going to be so, so beautiful. So be like Justin and open your heart and your mind and your soul to those incredible ideas that are just waiting for someone to collaborate with.